You're tuned to WFHB.
Volunteer powered,
listener supported.
Community radio for South Central Indiana.
Welcome to WFHB's Daily Local News.
Written and produced entirely by volunteers from the Bloomington community and supported by the generosity of listeners like you.
Good afternoon from the studios of Community Radio 91.3 FM. Reporting live for WFHB, this is Barbara Hupon.
And I'm Scott Weddle. This is the Daily Local News for Wednesday, June 13, 2018.
They're just a commodity crop, and we think that's particularly problematic in these backcountry areas that are supposed to be set aside for wilderness recreation.
In today's feature report, WFHB correspondent Jonah Chester speaks with Dr. Ray Schnapp, conservation director with the Indiana Forest Alliance, about the state-approved widespread logging in state forests. That's coming up later in the program.
Also coming up in the next half hour, our consumer watchdog segment, Better Beware, reminds listeners that anyone trying to collect money from you needs to do so in writing. But first, your daily headlines.
State Republicans gathered in Evansville for their party convention last Friday. Among the party platform items that were up for deliberation at the convention was the question of the definition of marriage. Currently, the Indiana Republican Party includes a definition of marriage as the union between a man and a woman. Convention delegates reaffirmed that definition on Friday. The definition of marriage was brought up after a political analyst in Indianapolis made a move to have the line removed from the Indiana Republican Party platform. Megan Robertson, a gay political consultant in Indianapolis, pushed to remove the man and woman definition from the party platform. Robertson has been active in Republican politics for over a decade and managed the Freedom Indiana campaign, which aimed to stop a constitutional ban on gay marriage. Robertson is also herself gay and says removal of the man and woman definition would have improved the Republican Party platform. She and supporters of the removal of the definition of marriage as the union between a man and a woman were quickly derided by conservatives in the state Republican Party. Michael Clark is the director of the Religious Conservative American Families Association of Indiana. Clark published a follow-up to his opinion editorial piece today, which reads in part, quote, "Most of the Indiana media wanted to turn this into some kind of battle over same-sex marriage so that they could defend the homosexual agenda, which is a favorite pastime of liberals," unquote. The language in the Indiana Republican Party platform defining marriage as between a man and a woman only dates back to 2016. Adding the definition was a policy triumph for religious conservatives, including then-Governor Mike Pence. This Saturday, Indiana State Democrats will meet in Indianapolis for their state's party's state convention. The Indiana Democratic Party agenda includes broadening union support and political redistricting. Delegates at the convention will also consider approving candidates for uncontested Democratic races in the state, including Jim Harper for Secretary of State, Jocelyn Whitaker for State Auditor, and John Aguilera for State Treasurer.
The Monroe County Community School Corporation is looking to adopt new curricula for its middle and high schools. These additions come after racist materials included in the district's elementary school social studies curriculum generated controversy earlier this year. The racist materials came in the form of a handout that circulated through the district's elementary schools. The handout included a suggested program meant to simulate slavery by using children as actors. The handout recommended that the students conduct a role-playing activity in which one child was a slave trader and the others were slaves. The handout resulted in backlash from parents and community members. The controversy pushed the school district to terminate its contract with Studies Weekly Incorporated, a curriculum vendor for the school district, which had provided the racist material. The outcry also pushed MCCSC officials to establish a review board to approve all future curriculum additions. The school district is also asking parents and community members to be more involved in the selection of new curricula. Communications Director for MCCSC, Andrew Clampett, says the school corporation has implemented new methods to prevent future issues. A new committee of parents and school officials has reportedly been vetting the recent submissions for the updated curricula.
There are about 100 people involved in, you know, reviewing materials, you know, from all of these curriculum companies that submitted materials, just seemingly night after night, going through materials, reading, reviewing, going through, using the tools to evaluate. And so it's just another step in the right direction. We want to be as transparent as possible, you know, with these curriculums, and, you know, this is a chance for the public to take a look at some of our options.
MCCSC will be holding an open house to give parents and community members an opportunity to review new curriculum additions. The event will be tomorrow from 9:30 to 11 a.m. and from 5 to 6:30 p.m. at the MCCSC facility on East Miller Drive.
Monroe County and the City of Bloomington are working right now on how best to distribute the newly established food and beverage tax. The 1% tax was approved in December last year in support of the Bloomington-Monroe County Convention Center expansion. Monroe County Auditor Kathy Smith told the Monroe County Council yesterday that under a temporary agreement, 85% of the tax proceeds will go to the city and 15% will go to the county. She said the challenge is distributing tax collected from businesses located in both city and county.
For instance, Kroger's. The Southside Kroger's is in the county. All the other Kroger's are in the city, but they pay a unified state sales tax.
Smith says County Attorney Jeff Cockerell is speaking with the city on the temporary arrangement.
And so there is not right now a clear picture of what that income is going to look like. It's still in its infancy, and he believes this will be a good cardinal split between the two until we establish the exact amount. And then we will reconcile it and balance it and redistribute as necessary the future income.
In regular business, the County Council approved additional appropriations for the Monroe County Public Library, the Monroe County Public Health Department, and Community Corrections. The Community Corrections appropriation comes from two Department of Corrections grants totaling $1.3 million. The Community Corrections Director, Tom Rhodes, says the county has received the grant since 1984, but the state has recently frozen a sizable chunk of it.
I'm somewhat concerned because for the last 5 years, the Department of Correction has not given us any increases to what used to be called our base dollars. And we have had salary increases, we've had other expenses, and so we have had to utilize user fees known as project income. Our project income has been depleting, and this has become a very big concern of mine. And hopefully folks will get together and inform the state that they need to be helping the local counties in taking care of community corrections.
Rhodes told the Monroe County Council that the term project income refers to the fees collected from offenders who are sentenced to home detention rather than incarceration.
Individuals who are sentenced to be on home detention, they are required to pay $12 per day. If they're on a GPS unit, we charge them an additional $4 a day. So you're looking at $16 a day to be on home detention. Many of our clients, they're struggling. They have to pay for their homes, for their food, for their family. And many of them, their income that they bring in from their service industry jobs mainly, really they are in a dire situation, and we try to collect the best we can based on their ability to pay. And so we may charge these fees, but we aren't collecting the full amount.
Those on home detention include low-level felons. The General Assembly mandated that low-level felons remain in their communities when it rewrote the criminal code in 2015. According to County Council member Marty Hawk, new changes to the state's sentencing guidelines could increase home detention numbers. Those changes become effective July 1st. Monroe County Corrections Director Rhodes referred to his annual budget as a fantasy budget. With the statewide rise in offenders, combined with depleting project income and frozen state support, Rhodes told council members that there's never enough money. Council members Cheryl Munson and Lee Jones voiced their support for taking up the issue with state legislators.
Each of the council members got a recent letter from members of the General Assembly telling us what the accomplishments of the legislative session of 2018 were and thanking us for the work we do locally, and say they believe in collaborative efforts between the state and local government. And this will ensure our community is one of the finest to do business, raise a family, and educate the next generation of Hoosier leaders. And they look forward to hearing from us. Don't hesitate to reach out. Well, let's reach out. They opened the door. Lee, you're the liaison with corrections, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes, I am.
Maybe some discussions in this regard. I would support the council expressing our concerns.
I think this would probably be a very opportune time to consider something along those lines.
The full Department of Corrections grant supports not only home detention, but also day reporting, the community transition program, and three of the county's specialty courts. The county council also made another $1 million available for the renovation underway at the Monroe County Public Library Ellisville branch. The library's executive director, Marilyn Wood, says the library has put aside money for several years to pay for the renovations.
Monroe County Youth Services Bureau is making plans for its third annual Monroe County Childhood Conditions Summit on December 6. Prevention Coordinator Stephanie Solomon updated the Monroe County Commissioners on the summit in the Commissioners' meeting this morning.
We're already planning for this year's summit, and we've identified our theme of connections, which I'm very excited about. We know connections to family, school, and community are protective, and we look forward to exploring the role of connections in improving youth health.
County commissioners approved a service agreement for the summit to be held at the Monroe Convention Center. The event brings together community members to discuss, explore, and generate ideas for action around the theme of child and adolescent health. Solomon says the third annual Monroe County Childhood Conditions Summit is not just for area service providers.
So we work at Youth Services Bureau within Monroe County Youth Council, and a lot of our council members attend and present, actually. And so it really is about childhood conditions, but not without the voice of our local youth.
In other news, Monroe County CASA is holding a training session for new child visit monitors on June 26th through the 28th. CASA board member Jim Shelton told commissioners applications are available online and due this Friday.
If you call 333-2272, you can ask for Susan Wanamaker. She's the coordinator for this effort, and it's an attempt to prioritize the children that are over 100 children that are on our wait list by having these child visit monitors visit the child once a month, or the children, there may be several in a family, and fill out a form that'll help the CASA office decide which children need CASAs the worst.
Shelton added the monitor position is a good entry point, being a full-fledged court-appointed special advocate.
Ellisville Fire Chief Mike Kornman is encouraging area residents to sign up with the online service smart911.com. Speaking in Monday's Ellisville Town Council meeting, Kornman said, "Emergency dispatchers are challenged to get important information from cell phone users. When landlines were prevalent, a caller's name and address would automatically come up for 911 dispatchers. Kornman says now 75% of 911 calls come from cell phones.
Cell phones cannot be populated to where you're at. They can triangulate a certain area based on the cell tower where you're calling from. It does not have all the information other than the number itself. So what happens is people don't know where you're at. They don't know what's going on. It's really a challenge for the dispatchers to get this information.
With Smart 911, users can create an online profile that includes names of family members, addresses, medical histories, even pet information.
It's whatever you want it to be. You can just put your name and phone number, or you can put everybody in your household's history, what kind of home you have, what's the construction type. It just goes to endless.
Kornman says he's registered his own family at smart911.com and says the services, quote, could be life-saving in an emergency, unquote. Support for WFHB comes from Cardinal Spirits Distillery, located on the Beeline. Cardinal Spirits has opened a new kitchen featuring local seasonal food made from scratch to complement their craft cocktails. Dinner is available Tuesday through Saturday at Cardinal Spirits, 922 South Morton Street. Reporting live for WFHB, I'm Barbara Fuqua.
And I'm Scott Weddle. Support for WFHB comes from listeners like you and from the IU Health Foundation, where local gifts stay local, serving patients for a healthier Bloomington.
Over the last year, the Indiana Department of Natural Resources logged several state forest areas and clear-cut old-growth trees. WFHB correspondent Jonah Chesta sat down with Dr. Ray Schnapp, Conservation Director with the Indiana Forest Alliance, to discuss how those logging efforts are impacting Indiana's woodland ecosystem.
Can you tell me a little bit about Indiana's logging over the last year? How much have we seen? Is it an increase compared to past years?
Well, it's certainly an increase over the levels a decade ago, but last year wasn't too different from the year before. So it hasn't gone up dramatically just in the last 2 years.
Where have we seen the most logging attempts? Has it been Yellowwood State Forest? Owen Putnam has also seen logging in the last few months. Is there anywhere that's been disproportionately affected by the state's logging efforts?
Yes, Yellowwood is a large state forest, and it is a popular one for them to log. A lot of their logging is in the Yellowwood State Forest and Morgan Monroe State Forest.
Why are those forests so popular for them to log, out of curiosity?
I mean, they are large, so there's like more timber there to be harvested. That would be one reason. And then it may have to do with the market and the species that are growing there in the market for those particular species at the time.
What kind of tree species are most sought after during these logging efforts?
Well, right now, of course, we are seeing a lot of our ash trees decline due to the emerald ash borer. And ash wood is pretty valuable, so they're calling it salvage harvest in some cases. They're taking a lot of ash trees out of the forest, and we have a concern about that because if there is any resistance among the ash population, we're not going to see it if we cut them down. I mean, some trees might be infested and yet survive and overcome the infestation, but if we cut them down, they don't have a chance to show their resistance.
So aside from not being able to develop a resistance, what other environmental impacts do we see from these logging efforts? I believe erosion was a concern. You're getting rid of roots that'll cause additional runoff. Is there anything else that environmental activists such as the Indiana Forest Alliance are worried about?
Well, sure. The impact of logging is really pretty dramatic. And even though they're doing mostly what they call selective harvest, where they don't necessarily take every tree in a tract, although they do create some small clearings. They call them small clearings, usually less than 10 acres, or up to 10 acres, I should say. But even the selective logging has a huge impact on the forest in that area because the soils are compacted and there's a lot of scraping of trees that are not necessarily the trees that are left standing, that are not necessarily the target trees that are meant to be removed. Many of them are still damaged in the process. And then, of course, the forest ecosystem is disturbed. And that disturbance is a concern for species that live there, especially species that may not be very capable of traveling. You know, birds could fly away, but some species that crawl are not necessarily going to get very far. They're not going to be able to leave the area. And so they will be impacted. And nobody is really looking at the impacts on shrews, for instance. We have several species of shrews that are relatively rare, so there can be big impacts on those species and on the forest ecosystem because those species are the foundation of the food chain.
So when a forest is clear-cut, or when segments of a forest are clear-cut, usually how long does that area take to recover? How long before we start seeing it return to its normal balance? Animals returning, they have a stable environment again. Are we talking a few months, a few years, maybe even a decade?
We would argue that it might take hundreds of years because there are some trees in there that are more than 200 years old. And if they're removing them, that particular sort of micro ecosystem is not going to return for a long time. Sure, vegetation will return, and often what you have during the first few years is a lot of invasive species. When you open up the forest floor to sunlight, and also even just the logging equipment can bring in invasive species, but when you open up the forest canopy and allow that sunlight to penetrate, you get kind of an explosion of growth of vegetation, but a lot of that will be very common species that are like garlic mustard and silt grass and things that are considered undesirable and invasive. So that vegetation might help control erosion, but it certainly doesn't mean that the ecosystem is back in balance.
So you said this could take centuries to grow back to its original form. So the environmental disruption this logging can cause can last that entire time then?
You know, to get back to where it was, it might take 100 years or more. But, I mean, that's one reason why we are advocating a longer rotation, that they typically harvest on a 20-year rotation, and we think that's way too short. That's too much disturbance.
What kind of rotation would you like them to see, like in terms of a longer rotation, that 20 years?
Well, 80 or 100 years would be good. You know, this is a subject of scientific study and debate. There's a lot we don't know yet about forest ecology. There are many, especially like predator and prey relationships, that we don't really understand. And I think it's kind of arrogant to think that we can manipulate these systems and predict the outcome, because there's just a lot going on there that isn't very well understood yet from a scientific point of view. And there is quite a bit of ongoing research and debate in the literature.
So are there any current logging projects that the Indiana Department of Natural Resources or its subcontractors are carrying out that particularly trouble the Indiana Forest Alliance and environmental activists in the state? Is there anything going on right now that listeners should be aware of?
Well, there is logging going on right now, but what particularly concerns us is logging in the backcountry areas that have previously been set aside from logging for many years. So there has been a chance for older growth to develop there. And there is sort of a variety of opinions about what constitutes old growth. But these areas that have been allowed to be undisturbed for quite a while have the potential to develop into really old growth conditions. And a 100-year-old tree in Indiana is not really very old. I mean, we have species that can live for 500 years, and it would be really awesome if we were planning now to make sure there are some 500-year-old trees 500 years from now. And with our current 20-year rotation, we're not planning that at all. We're treating our state forests as if they're just a commodity crop, and we think that's particularly problematic in these backcountry areas that are supposed to be set aside for wilderness recreation.
Is there anything else you want to add to the record that you think it's important for our listeners to be aware of, for this logging situation, for the future, the effects it's had on the environment, basically anything you think deserves airtime that I did not cover today?
I think that a lot of people maybe have not even visited our state forest, but they appreciate the fact that we have state forests. And in the Yellowwood backcountry area, we characterize tree age in some portions of that forest, and we found some trees that were 230 years old. I think, like most Hoosiers, probably don't realize that we have forests that are that old. And it's really cool that we have those resources and we should protect them. And if people care about our state forest, they should get involved.
The Daily Local News is brought to you by MPI Solar, a Bloomington business specializing in solar hot water, solar electricity, and solar hot air systems. MPI Solar designs and installs solar power generation systems that encourage independence and individual responsibility. Found locally at 812-334-4003 and on the web at mpisolarenergy.com.
Up next, our weekly consumer watchdog segment, Better Beware.
Welcome to Better Beware. Here's your consumer watchdog from WFHB Community Radio with the latest information and helpful hints designed to keep your head out of the clouds, your feet on the ground, and your money in your pocket.
Here on Better Beware, we try to give you a heads up on various scams that are running around and some advice on how not to fall for them. But our advice tends to get split up and handed out in whatever pieces relate to the con job du jour. So now we're going to give you a list of some basic do's and don'ts that everyone needs to remember to stay safe in our modern world, starting with some things to not do. Do not answer your phone ever unless you recognize the number on your caller ID, and never call back just to find out who it was. A legitimate caller will leave a voicemail. If there's no voicemail, forget about it. In fact, if I don't know the number and there's no voicemail, I block that caller. Sometimes crooks do leave voicemail, though, so remember, do not give out your personal information to anyone who calls you, no matter what they say and no matter who they say they are. If you think the call might be legitimate, hang up and you call them using a number you found, a number that's publicly listed. Do not respond at all to any sudden demand for money that hits you from out of the blue. If you ever actually do owe money to the government for taxes or fines or anything, or if you really do owe money to some company, they will always, always send you something in the U.S. mail first. If somebody wants money and you haven't gotten anything in the mail, it's a scam every time. And do not believe your friend or family member is in trouble if somebody else says they are. Scammers get around the nothing-in-the-mail tip-off by inventing a sudden emergency. They claim somebody you know and love has been arrested or injured or kidnapped. And if you get that kind of a message from anyone you don't know personally, no matter who they claim to be, hang up and check it out. First, call the alleged victim. If you can't get hold of them, call the authorities or the hospital or whoever is supposed to be involved using a public number you looked up. Never use a number the caller gives you. Do not send money by wire transfer or prepaid money card to anyone you don't know personally. It's really best to never use those methods at all. They're fast and convenient, but they're also untraceable and irrevocable, and the hands-down favorites for the fraudsters. If you're going to pay some money to someone for something, write a check or use a credit card, not a debit card. Well, what do you know? We're almost out of time, and I haven't even gotten to the do's. Well, keep listening, and we'll continue this list in the future. Meanwhile, make good choices and stay safe. I'm Richard Fish for WFHB News and Public Affairs.
Better Beware comes to you from WFHB Bloomington, Indiana. Find all our episodes at wfhb.org. If you can help put the kibosh on a con, email beware@wfhb.org. Remember, swindlers never give a sucker an even break.
You've been listening to the Daily Local News on WFHB. Today's headlines were written by Jonah Chester and Wes Martin, along with Sarah Vaughn for Cats Week in partnership with Community Access Television Services. Better Beware was produced by Richard Fish. Our feature was produced by Jonah Chester.
Our engineer today is Wes Martin. Our theme music provided by Ben Lumsdaine, Danny Graff, and Scott Schmadeke. Executive producer is Wes Martin. For WFHB, this is Scott Weddle.
And I'm Barbara Fuqua. Thanks for supporting Indiana's only volunteer-powered, listener-supported, independent daily news program.
And you can be a part of our award-winning news team. Send inquiries to news@wfhb.org. And stay tuned for the Hijabi Diaries, examining the experiences and issues facing Muslim women. The Hijabi Diaries are coming up next on WFHB.
You've been listening to the Daily Local News on WFHB Bloomington Community Radio. Our news is written and reported by volunteers working to provide local news, cover local issues, and strengthen our local community. We invite you to participate. You may submit questions, comments, and story ideas to news@wfhb.org. You can become a Daily Local News volunteer by attending new volunteer orientation. You can find an archive of past shows and individual news reports online at wfhb.org and catch live broadcasts of the Daily Local News Monday through Thursday at 5 p.m. We are local, longer.